Where the tape looks like it's beginning.
Introduction here. Oh,
you're just too anxious to get going.
You're just too, you're just gonna, you know, and put then, a little food in you and you just get ready to go.
No, but I'll probably die just as quick on the other end. So.
Well, meanwhile, I'll get off to a slow start with a full stomach. This is Paul Rodell again, IVS Oral History Project. I'm here tonight. What is the date? Today is
28th.
The 28th. Yeah. Okay. June 28th. It's a Friday, I hear. And I'm sitting in the dining area of Robert, but prefers Bob Palmer. And we're in Oxford, Maine. Bob was in Vietnam from 1959 through 61. Second time around, 62 through 64. Agriculture, in a variety of roles, and we'll let Bob tell us all about that. In the meantime, to start off, the question that I prepped you for, even before I turned it on, we've been asking people to tell us a little bit about themselves based on their own ideas of what made them what they were. So, when they were born and raised, and any influences that they think were, you know, the most salient, to use the big words, in their life. And this is the point that I can just turn it over to you, and then I just get to sit back and listen. And you know, and just take it easy.
That's interesting. I'd like to hear what some of the other IBSs have had to say about this. Never reflected on it very much. I was adopted when I was 4 years old. I came out of Biddeford and started life in Bryant Pond, Maine with my folks, new folks.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was a mill superintendent there. A year later, had a brother. He was adopted. He came on his birthday, I believe. And we moved into New Hampshire during the war. Dad was assigned there to work on some kind of detonator for submarines. And then we finally came back to Maine and working on the my grandfather's farm, my dad did. And all of that time, up until that time, he had 100% attendance at Sunday school and church. But somehow when I got to Maine, that was not so important for whatever reason. But always, excuse me, always figured I was going to be a farmer. My grandfather was, and my dad wasn't really a farmer, but worked with farmers, worked in agriculture.
Yeah, for at least a little while.
And, well, he was a teacher in the GI Bill of Rights, the guys who came back, and then he taught BOAG and NOE. And my uncle was a forestry professor at the University of Maine. He used to go up and visit with him. And
so even though it's not growing crops, the food it was nonetheless, still, yeah.
So I went to the University of Maine, was going to be a veterinarian.
Uh-huh.
And my dad didn't think that was the wisest choice because I couldn't even spell it. And so I tried tried ag engineering.
He's about as good a speller as I am then.
And then I ended up in ag economics, farm management, and and ag education.
Uh-huh.
And the first job, well, I worked for the department, ag economics department, as a field enumerator, covered all the state. We're working on apples the first year. So had quite a contact.
As a what?
Just collecting information for people professors and doctors doing research, but going out and interviewing the farmers and having all the packers or whatever.
You said enumerator.
Right, field enumerator.
Okay, all right, okay.
And
I wasn't acquainted with that.
You hadn't heard that?
Okay.
Huh.
All right.
So, I don't know. I think probably what touched my imagination was my third and fourth grade teacher, Mildred Fox, and we studied the Belgium Congo.
Uh-huh.
And went into it in great detail. We went down the river and did all kinds of things. I think maybe that's where I got my interest in going overseas.
Really? That early?
And so when I was at the university, was applying for jobs junior year. United Fruit was where I wanted to go. I wanted to go to Central America. And they weren't hiring unless you had some experience, and that was the case with all of them. And somehow I got a hold of a flyer from IVS. I can't remember what the route was. I think my major professor had picked it up someplace and gave it to me, and I wrote and told him I was interested. Now this was my senior year, and I never heard from him.
Really?
Never heard from him. And so then I took a teaching job down in West Buxton, teaching BOAG and science, and had a moment to reflect. And I wrote another letter to IVS, and kind of critical. I said I could understand why our relations overseas were probably so bad if we treated those people the same way IVS evidently treated their unsuccessful candidates. And so then I heard back from Dr. Nossinger shortly, and they were interested and wanted me to leave right off. And I think the reason they were interested then was because I had some teaching experience for WAG. So,
did they ever say why they didn't respond?
No. Well, that did come a little bit later.
Okay.
Indirectly, right. I think. So anyway, I knew we were going to go.
Is that part of the story that's coming up? Okay, all right.
They wanted me to go right away.
You got my curiosity piqued here.
And I said, no, I had to finish the school year. The vocational program, the ag program, went another month beyond the regular one. So anyway, knew we were going to Vietnam, never heard of Vietnam. Indochina, we could find something about that in the encyclopedias and all, but really anxious about it. Didn't care where we were going. Just so excited to be going. They brought me into Washington.
And this was why?
Pardon me?
Because of the interest from the fourth grade.
Well, I think so. Yeah. I don't know. That's all I can think. But I knew I wanted to go overseas. I didn't care why. Where.
Okay. All right.
And I was disappointed because I didn't see how I was going to do it without any experience. All of the companies had to have so many years' experience.
So was this also a means to gain experience for later, too?
It turned out that way, but...
But it wasn't part of the motivation?
No.
Okay.
But it was funny. So I got into Washington on the weekend and went up to the IBS office. I met with Dr. Nossinger, and it was funny. He was a very patient man, big guy, red hair, yeah. And we were sat down at the office, and he talked a little bit about the crew that had preceded me, which I probably could have been in if I'd been ready to leave school or all. But he said, Mr. Plummer, I want to tell you there's one thing you must have when you work overseas. Yes, what is that? Really actually says you must have patience and patience and patience and patience and patience. And I guess that's what he was telling me about my nasty little letter. Can't be too anxious to get things done. There are lots of different ways to get things done.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, like you and your brother-in-law, taking 2.5 years to plan out the.
Yeah. Well, actually,
that you're doing
actually,
now.
That my brother, he's really the brains behind the.
Oh, okay.
But he's very methodical, and we've been in business before. Phil and I, we built a tavern. And ran that. Another brother managed it. We built a tavern, and we expanded that, doubled the space the second year, and ran it for 3 or 4 years, and did really well. We bought property in in Florida. Rented that out. We bought property in woodlots here in Maine. So we've been working together, but this is the really big project. But, but Phil's been thinking about it a long time, too.
So he would have been a good Knopf singer.
Oh, he would have been. Oh, he'd been excellent. Yes, he would. Yeah, yeah. Works with people very well, good memory. Sees the big picture. I think maybe I am too narrowly focused sometimes, a good part of the time probably. Goal-orientated, but maybe you don't see the big picture sometimes. And I think working overseas has helped broaden that. I don't know what would have happened to me if I'd never gone.
Yeah.
But then we met Vera Lanier in California.
Uh-huh.
And, God, he was great because he had been an iffy student in National Farm Youth Exchange with the 4-H.
Okay.
And spent 6 months in Japan.
Uh-huh.
And they had stopped. I suppose he had some kind of orientation in Hawaii, so we stopped in Hawaii, met the extension agent there, and he took us all over the island while we were there. Saw the sugar plantations and the pineapple. That was a good introduction. Went to Japan, and some of the farm, we were only there a day or two, but some of the farm families, he'd lived with 12 farm families, I think, when he was there. Some of them came to meet him at the in Tokyo, but can't remember his name, but the head of the Japanese counterpart to 4-H,
uh-huh,
met us at the airport, took us to the office, took us to his home, had sukiyaki that night.
Uh-huh.
Really, really treated well.
Uh-huh.
And then we went on to Hong Kong, and that was the first real introduction to Asia for me. Japan, not so much. We were with Burl's friend, but didn't really see much of Japan that short visit.
Uh-huh.
Hong Kong was quite an opening. And then on to Vietnam. I remember flying over Vietnam, looking down, and played chess, and looking at the rice fields. And it looked just like a chess board.
Yeah, different patches of green.
Yeah, different, yeah. And we landed in Saigon, and I remember we both went out the door and couldn't believe it was that hot, that muggy. I said, it's got to be the heat from the engines, from the airplane, but it wasn't.
Hi.
What would you like in your car?
Oh, both.
Oh.
Yeah.
Dad.
Yeah, Dad.
Thank you.
Oh, how nice. What did he give you?
I think it was a tick.
Oh.
Yeah. Here.
I don't know if you can stay here, baby.
I think he could probably stay here. But Andrew is quiet. He's just sucking on a bottle.
Yeah.
He's happy enough to be there.
And
let me get the door.
Yeah. Sorry.
There we go.
And I don't know what they did with you. You were a larger group, but IBS, when anybody new came in, whoever was in the area at the time would come out to the airport and meet him.
A little greeting party thing.
Yeah. And they did that when I arrived, and we did it when I left. They did it when I left. And that made you...
I'm sorry, I'm supposed to get that, thank you. Okay. Dad, just let me know when you want me to...
Yeah.
Okay, we'll give it all to you.
He's probably, set for a long time.
Made you feel comfortable and like a team.
Uh-huh.
And then it seems the next day, the first thing they did was take us to USOM, introduce us to the technicians and the people who were working there.
Wow, this is good.
This is good.
This is good coffee.
Wait long enough. Right?
Wow.
And then we went and met some of the Vietnamese officials, which I think was the right way to do it. They knew within a day or two, assuming it wasn't on the weekend or something, that new people were in.
Oh, they probably were. Were they told before?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so it wasn't the...
It wasn't brand new, but...
Yeah.
I...
Mama. Mama. Mama.
Yeah, I Andrew wants mama.
Oh, you gotta go?
Okay.
Right. It was good visiting with you.
Yeah.
Come on back when you get ready. Come on back when you get ready. That'll be fun. Okay, bye-bye.
So we lost one now.
Yeah.
And we're back down to two.
I'm sure he'll be back.
So, let's see, we kind
of... I enjoyed the story about stepping out and feeling the heat, because we were told in advance that there would be this rumble as they would open the door of the plane and it would be the hot air coming down.
Yeah. So,
and the shirts would go...
so you were expecting it.
We got warned from a former volunteer who was in our training. It was one of the trainers. Yeah. But you had a full shock.
We had a full shock. And see, and Burl didn't have any experience like that in Japan.
Right.
You know, the climate was similar to ours.
Mm-hmm. But,
And he came from Montana, so they had pretty hot weather there, but maybe it's dry. But boy, I just couldn't believe that. But you get used to it pretty quick, too.
Yeah, what were some of the other first impression things that you had?
Another one was my first introduction to the hot sauce.
Uh-huh.
They didn't keep us in Saigon very long. We went out to Hung Lok, which was the first station. It was outside of Saigon, about 30 miles, I think. I can't remember, 15 or 30 miles. And
mm-hmm.
They didn't have a kitchen, and they ate at the local restaurant. Or maybe it was the time, anyway. We went to the local restaurant. And... they had the hot sauce, and Burl was saying, "Well, you got to be careful. It's really hot." And I was going to be careful, and I tried it, and because I was sweating like a pig, and rubbed my forehead, wiped my eyes, and got it in my eyes before I ever tasted it. And it's true. That was a bad one.
What a great way to discover how hot it really is.
We were there a day. Then I guess we went on up to Bao Lok, which was the next station. That was where the Ag College was. Mm-hmm. Bob Pulaski was there. And it was kind of getting up and a little bit cooler, which was some mm-hmm. relief for people just getting there. And we met the station manager. And we went on to Delat, the old French city. And we were going to stay there over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And had a really nice villa. Oh, that was a beautiful place. Not very IBS-ious, but... And that's where I came down with dysentery. I was so sick, or I thought I was. And they were all going out night clubbing or something. And Verl never got the dysentery on the Oriental food. But when we went back into America, that's when he would get it. And that really pleased me. I never told him that, but I was glad he... When we'd go to the Clark and was eating American food, then he'd get it. But there was, I can't remember the guy's name, entomologist. Anyway, he came in and gave me some charcoal pills. And
just charcoal?
Yeah, and that started to take care of the problem. And I thought he was one of the finest men I'd ever seen in my life. Anyway, we continued on. Made a tour of all the stations, went down to Phong Ron. That was very, very dry and hot. Went out to Na Chong, and then the whole group met there. There was a holiday. And then we were assigned to our language training. And both Burl and I went back to Bao Lok, the uh-huh. Blau, where the Ag School was. Bob Falasco was there, and Dick Knerstedt. No, Dick Cagle. He was an engineer. Bob was a horticulturalist. And Bob was leaving for vacation, so it was Verl and I, and the interpreter. And he didn't know beans. So half a day...
The interpreter didn't know?
Oh, no, the interpreter did. Oh, he was really shocked.
Oh,
they
okay.
brought him in from, I think, it wasn't his regular station, but he was the language interpreter.
Oh, okay. All right.
So he came up, and we'd study language half a day, and then the rest of the time we were supposed to be out to the nursery
uh-huh.
Working with them. Verl had some experience with irrigation. I didn't. And that's where I met tropical agriculturalist Lewandowski, guy who was good. And what they were propagating rubber trees and coffee and tea out there. Uh-huh. And he was starting cacao and avocados. And they were doing it under mist propagation. They'd have, they put the seedlings in, they'd have mist over 24 hours a day, and they would propagate much faster. And he spoke French, as a lot of the Vietnamese did. Uh-huh. And
did you have any French?
I had no French. Okay. Should have, coming from Maine, but I didn't. No, I didn't. Oh, that was another thing. Going to school, I took college ag, and the only difference between college ag and the college course in Maine, probably anyway, was that instead of having a foreign language, French, usually it was French, you had vocational agriculture. And I never took any language, a foreign language in college, and that scared me to death. And I was thinking, that was really crazy, because the first, you know, first major job I had, I could have used French, or I suppose any training in any foreign language helps you for the next time. And but I was so scared of foreign language, and then got into Vietnamese, and I sure wasn't an expert in Vietnamese, but I think that 2 weeks at Falasco was gone, and we were at the station. I think that was a good way to do it, hard way to do it, and I think
you were on your own,
right? Okay. But then again, you know, the station manager spoke both English and French, so we were lucky, I think, with the Vietnamese, because they all the people that I worked with, most all of them, had facility in French and English. But it was good. Verl and I were about equal in language study, and you'd go along, and it seems to me you'd hit a plateau, and you'd look like you're learning anything, it would take so long, but I think if Verl had been a lot faster, I would have got discouraged quick, but we're about the same.
Yeah.
And that was a good assignment, because again, we lived in a, what was it, two room, it was on the college campus. Mm-hmm. And we had an apartment which would be the same as one of the professors. In fact, our next door neighbor was a professor, but there were four of us. We had a living room and a bedroom.
And this is in Bao Lac?
This was Bao Lac.
Okay.
But we ate on the local market. Mm-hmm. So every meal we'd go downtown, which was about a block, and we had about three restaurants that we'd circulate between. And food never bothered me. I enjoyed it, but it was all new. But our favorite was sweet rice with condensed milk. We'd mix that up, kind of like rice pudding, and that was always our dessert. That was Bob Falasco, and we picked it up from him. And it was fun because the villagers and the people in the restaurant looked, you know, they knew we'd be coming in. Whether they enjoyed us or not, they always made you feel like they were glad you were there, you know.
Well, they probably were glad.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. And then Bob was a great guy. Well, anyway, after he came back, then I was assigned to Bao Lac, and Verl went to Canto, the rice station. Mm-hmm. And Bob was really good. He liked the Vietnamese, he liked the food, he liked to visit, he was very outgoing. I remember on the weekends we'd go down to the market, and he'd sit down, squat down in front, talk to the ladies selling the eels or whatever they were selling, and I think they could tell, you know, that he was not artificial, and enjoyed being there, and they enjoyed having him there. Plus, I can't remember if he had if he spoke French or Hungarian or something, but he had a good contact with the French plantation owners in the area, and he would go out and visit them sometimes, those growing coffee and tea. So he had he knew everybody in at the college. He was not teaching at the college, but knew the professors there. His job was at the at the research station, the extension station, part of the university, part of the college. He traveled all over the place, and I went with him. And I don't know, sometime, and was working with Dan Lewandowski, the USOM technician, and they all came through Blau. Most of the technicians came through Blau because it was on the way to DeLaw. Everybody liked DeLaw, and they liked the IBS house and all that. But they'd all stop. They'd all stop there. But then I got assigned to the Hunlock station, which was a row crop. They were introducing new crops, and then the other side of the station was the animal husbandry.
So how long were you at this the first assignment then?
I was there, God, I can't remember now.
Well, first let me back up. What time in 1959 did you arrive?
July.
And so in July,
yeah,
okay.
So then we had the language training a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. And then 2 weeks for language.
Back. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that continued, but I mean, that was, it was supposed to have been a full, study for the full 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't do that, we couldn't do that because Bob was away, so we did half days and then out to the station, which was probably about all Burl and I could take at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the opportunity to use what we had been studying with. And the advantage, another thing I left out was Chi, Boisson Chi, the language teacher. Ah, he was excellent. He had French too, of course. And a very gifted boy, very, very smart, and well-liked by all of the officials that we came in contact, which is quite different than some of my experiences later. It seems to me the interpreter, that's what we call them. I think there is a better name, but I think they can kill or break a relationship individually or for a whole effort. But the ones that we had in those early days were really outstanding. And I think you'll probably be seeing Chi. He's in the D.C. area. Mm-hmm. I think he came down from Hue in the big exodus, as I think all of almost all of the interpreters or their families. But that would...
You mean the exodus of 75?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think... God, no. Memory gets fuzzy. I think he was Catholic, as most of those were, but it was kind of a combination Catholic, Buddhism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But very important, we're left there alone with Chi, and he was serious. You know, we could have goofed off and forgot language training and not worry about getting to the station. I'm sure we weren't that valuable at the station, but the regimentation and the requirement of being there and trying to learn something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you wonder just how much good we did then.
Did your language improve a great deal? You're being modest.
I was not one of the great language learners, but I think we could get along without help. If we could control the conversation, then we felt pretty comfortable about it. But but I think it was I had problems with the tones. I don't think I ever picked up the tones. No, I don't think I ever did. And so if the word was one that I recognized, I put it where I thought it was supposed to be. Burl, I think he may have been a little better. Mm-hmm. I remember there were three or four of us in Hong Kong once, and we're on vacation. Dick Kirsten and Burl and I, and I think Burl said, well, he understood more than he could speak. And Dick and I laughed, thought that was kind of funny. How could you understand more than you can speak? But I thought about that over time, and I do understand that now. I think he probably did understand more than that. But recognizing the limitations right off are important, I think. And language would be the first one that Vietnamese or any people can tell whether you know what they're talking about or whether you know what you're talking about if you're trying to do it in their language. but I think it was one of the big introductions. You go into a village and speak their language, mm-hmm. and even though you don't do it right, they appreciate that. But then the other side of that is, you know, they probably would expect nothing different. Why would they expect somebody to come in speaking something they never heard? So, I don't know just how that went. You know, if you're working with the headmaster or somebody in the village and you come in to introduce whatever it is you're trying to do, but then again, we had the interpreters too, but I mean, if you couldn't speak Vietnamese, why would they pay any attention to you in the first place, except you look funny and...
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But yeah, language training was very, very important. I don't think it could be stressed too much. And I think the people who learned it quick and well were more effective than those who took longer mm-hmm. to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Hung Lock. Had a great time there.
But not necessarily. I put it back on again.
But so, anyway, Hung Lock.
Yeah, you really liked it here. I mean, I could tell that.
I did.
And why did they transfer you?
Well, I think the idea was that... There was a big plan, which, again, I was too narrowly focused and didn't see, but Lewandowski, who was introducing cacao and avocados,
uh-huh.
and the government was having problems with the Hill Tribe people,
uh-huh.
because, you know, the slash and burn and moving around, they could never keep track of them, and security was just becoming a problem.
Uh-huh.
I didn't realize that. I didn't uh-huh. see that as a problem, but... people in the government did, and Lewandowski, who was...
He was AID.
He was AID,
right.
So I'm right.
Yeah.
He was the horticulturalist. He identified with them. He wanted them to be able to, you know, keep their customs and all that. Otherwise, what they were talking about was penning them in, like the stockade, way back. So he came... I think it was his idea, and you should talk to Bob Flasker. He knows more about it, saying, you know, if we could get something... So they'd have a cash crop and stay.
Yeah.
Then you know, the government won't have such a problem, and they won't have to slash and burn.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the idea of the Hung Lock station, the crop, was to grow the cacao for distribution, and that was my job, to introduce them to the villages and work on extension. Introducing mostly cacao, but also avocado. We had a great team down there. Harvey Neese was there for a short time. Dave Nuttall on the animal husbandry side, and Don Sumner was there on the crop side, and the college kids from Blau, and then the two vocational colleges. From Hue and Kanto came there for study,
uh-huh.
and so worked with the ag students there, worked with cacao, traveled all over that part of South Vietnam, and worked also there with some of the Chinese farmers. You didn't see many Chinese farmers, but there were some, and the French, because cacao needed to grow under shade.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, then... Oh, and then the best part, the very best part, was while I was down there, Harvey Neese and Bob Flasker and Lewandowski had taken a trip downriver to some of the Mar villages, and they were the ones that took the first cacao plants into these villages. And so on the second trip, they invited me to go. We were, the purpose of the trip was to see if they had established the nursery and put up the canopy and all that. Oh, that was just fabulous. Went down river, that was about a day.
Uh-huh.
Stopped at the first village, and they were really glad to see Bob and Dr. Lewandowski. And then they bring out the rice wine at night. That was terrible, terrible stuff. and the music.
You don't like Raceway?
Oh, well, what they did is they had the big clay jug, and the women would go down to the muddy river and fill it up, and then you'd have the big straw put in there, and yeah, you were drinking. You know, it was pretty heavy sediment. It hadn't really acted. It hadn't been in there long enough to act very much, but. And then you hold your nose and go around and around and around and around until everybody fell out. But they had done an amazing job. We went to three or four villages. It was about a day, half a day between villages. We go. Uh-huh. They had done a tremendous job, just the way they had been instructed to put up the nursery. I guess I made two trips there. And so we were still distributing the cacao and growing that and getting it out and checking. And then they were going to open the station in Hue, and they asked me to do it. Yeah.
And for you to be the head honcho.
The first guy to go to Hue. A whole bunch of us had gone up to see the old palace. And we traveled. Uh-huh. There were two groups. One of us, we drove up by Land Rover, and then the other group came up by train, had the Land Rover, and we went back by train. Uh-huh. We were up there about a week, and so it was not, you know, I'd been in the area, they had an ag college there. Uh-huh. The idea was to help the ag college. Well, no, it wasn't really a college, it was like a secondary school.
Okay.
And the kids lived right there, but to get some practical experience.
Yeah.
And there was one of the professors there was animal husbandry, and I think he'd been to the States, and it was because of him that they asked for IBS. And so I went the first day.
Do you remember his name?
Oh, I can't.
Okay.
I can't, but it may come to me.
All right.
What was his name? Can't remember. So my the driver, I think we were now using drivers. I can't remember. Uh-huh. I think we had drivers, and the interpreter were coming by vehicle, and I flew in, and somebody met me at the airport from the school.
Uh-huh.
And spoke French, you know, because I didn't speak any French. He took me over to the, meet the headmaster.
Uh-huh.
And he spoke French, and I didn't. But we get along really well. They were very patient and taught a lot of English. And the kids were all ready, you know, they had their farm gardens and all. So that was the introduction into Hue. But again, got started on extension, and that grew. So I was there about a year. That grew to quite a big station. I think the guys that came in after me, they were all over the area. But it was a great experience. Then Don Luce asked me to come back as a team leader. I came back to Maine, taught Milo, was teaching chemistry, physics, biology. Hardest job I ever had in my life.
Well, I'm not following something here. When did you finish up in Hue?
I was there about a year.
About a year.
So I was 6 months at Blau.
So about a year and a half. No. So far we got.
No, I was 6 months at, and 6 months at Hung Lau.
Oh, okay.
That was my year. My first year was between those two.
Between
stations.
Those two. Oh, okay. I wasn't adding
my last
up, right?
Year was at Hue.
All right. And then?
And I came back home.
To the United States.
United States.
Okay, I was wondering about that in your description of 59, 61, then 62, 64. I would have thought it would be 59, 64, but there's an actual break at home that accounts for that.
Came back and took driver's ed so I could teach.
Mm.
And
went back to the high school to teach, or what was it?
I had an offer in Portland.
Uh-huh.
The teacher there had a heart attack, and he was all right, but he couldn't teach for a while, so it was a half year. And I went down and talked to everybody, and went to the superintendent and was prepared to take the job, and asked for a contract, and he wouldn't give it to me.
Uh-huh.
And so I, if you won't give me a contract, I wouldn't teach.
Sure, of course.
And, well, I can see now he was keeping it open for the...
Oh, for the other guy, yeah.
I suppose, but anyway. Right. And so then I got a job up in Milo, that's up in north central Maine, and was teaching high school chemistry.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher before me was the medical doctor in town. Oh. And they had had some kind of falling out, and the principal was a PhD.
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of unusual in Maine at the time. But that was one of the hardest jobs. That was harder than anything I ever did in Vietnam. Those kids in high school chemistry, they were doing as much chemistry then as I had done in college.
Ooh.
And so
they really
chemistry,
pushed them.
Oh, God, pushed me. And biology in the biology labs, and I had a general science. And stayed up there, boarded up there. And I usually, you know, do the lesson plans, and I was ahead of the kids on Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday were about even, and I think Thursday and Friday they were ahead of me. It was hard going in, and the guy that I replaced was good, but that was a hard year. So anyway, then IBS called.
They called you.
Yeah, they had a job in Nigeria, I think they were thinking about.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And
I think that's ironic, because you were the one who couldn't get them to answer the first
letter.
Yeah,
that's right.
And then you come home.
Well, they did. I think what happened is the group that went out before me, Harvey, there was a big group that went out.
Uh-huh.
And I think they were processing them.
Uh-huh.
And
so they set you aside.
And
you were
was,
a little bit too late, maybe.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was a one-man office, pretty much. I think yeah. Dr. Nelsinger did. I don't remember anybody else's. I met his, I think it was his niece.
Uh-huh.
When I was there, I think she was had just graduated, probably from Georgetown, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But she might have helped. But I don't think there was anybody in the office. I think
yeah.
he did most of the work, and it just.
He's no longer alive, is he?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Too bad.
Yeah. It was, and then there was Dr. Riddell. Now it's like your name. There's no relation.
Really?
Yeah. He followed Dr. Riddell. How do you say your name, Rodell?
Yeah. R-O.
This is Riddell.
Okay.
He was, anyway, so it was interested, and then I was interested in getting kind of excited about that, and then that fell through, and then they said, no, they'd like to have me go to Vietnam and go back as a team leader, and Don Luce was, he was chief of party now, and Don was in that group preceded me. Don was
in that
yeah.
Ag group,
yeah.
So he would have gone
Don
over.
Don and Bob Flasker and Ray Boughton and Harvey Neese.
Mm-hmm.
And
lots of names that I keep on hearing.
Yeah,
you'll meet.
I hope you meet Flasker in D.C. You got to see him, and you'll meet Harvey Neese. Well, he's out in Idaho. Are you going to get out there or no?
Not me.
No.
Maybe Mark.
And Burr Frucci. You know, too bad you can meet some of those guys.
What's the last name?
Burr Frucci, he was out there.
I'll look him up.
Burr was originally a Maine boy.
Uh-huh.
And well, I can't remember. He's out there with Harvey. I think they're out in Idaho.
Hmm.
I think Harvey's still guy. He's been to Russia. Works for aid, I believe, on the contract. Burr, I can't remember what Burr is doing.
It's B-U-R, no?
B-U-R-R, I think. Frucci.
As soon as she comes in, she's going to want to pick out.
Yeah.
What? The dog, you're going
yeah,
in and
yeah,
out.
Yeah, that's
out,
typical.
You know. Hmm. Well, he's not on this list that I've got.
Burr Frucci isn't there?
No. This is the second
yeah, he was at Bama too.
Discrepancy that I've seen, that I've found.
Burr should have been there. Dick Kirsten, you got Dick Kirsten?
Well, first.
Kirsten's on your way.
B U R R.
F R U T C H E Y, I believe.
F R U T I.
No, F Frucci, F R U T C H E Y, like Lucci.
Okay, C H E Y. And his first name was what?
Burr. Oh, I don't know what. No, Burr was his first name.
Oh, B U R R. Oh, and then Frucci is a second name.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Burr. I don't know what it, never heard him call him, but Burr.
Okay, all right. And he was Vietnam, what years?
He was out, he was with a, with,
Same group as Luce?
Yeah, same group as Luce, I think.
Hmm.
He and Harvey and Luce and Ray Boughton and a couple of his, Sutton.
Yeah, a lot of
work. There was a big. It was that was the first big group that had gone out. I think with
mm-hmm.
when Gordon was chief of party, Gordon brought me along.
Okay.
Okay, so went back, worked for Don. Was team leader and.
Oh, so then I was looking at the wrong space. If it's F.
Yeah, Frucci.
Oh.
Last name. You must have Frucci.
Oh, this is Laos. Wait a minute. Hang on. Vietnam. Oh, there we go.
Where is Burr?
Okay, now that was just a country list. Now let's look at the addresses.
I think he's in Idaho with Harvey somewhere.
Because I can't recall if we heard back from him. And we had a good response, but not complete. Cataldo, Idaho. He did hear back. We did hear back from him. Okay. So, but he's not in my head because I'm not going to go there.
No, that's too bad. I wish you could meet those guys.
I will meet some of them.
Spark plugs. They were out in the Bamatuit station. That was the big station. Mm-hmm. That was the favorite of all the IBSs. And Burr was there. Javi was there. I got out there traveling per diem and saw the station and looking at cacao out there. But that was really the heart and soul of IBS until I guess we moved into Saigon and branched out.
Mm-hmm.
But so when we went back,
this is now the 62.
Right.
What time in 62?
Again, it was right after school closed, July, I think.
Okay.
And Mike Chilton, who had been out there before, was team leader, and I was team leader. It was still mostly agriculture. I had the what we call the coastal lowlands and the delta, and Mike had the uplands thing, included.
Oh, so that's the way that IVS was divided at that time.
Yeah, at least for the team leader positions at that time.
Okay, all right.
Because and that Mike had DeLaw, he'd been at DeLaw and Bamatuit and Blau and Zilling.
Mm-hmm. Gee, he had the nice high places.
Yeah, well,
and you were on the coast
then
in the
Delta. He was a horticulturist.
Mm-hmm.
Horticulturist, and they've done some good work with onions and stuff up in the lot. But anyway, it was fine with me. I liked it. And then we started introducing, IBS started bringing in the education teams, and a lot of those went to the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very small when they started. And so he and I had responsibility for
The education as well as for the ed.
And health teams. And then as that grew, then they brought in another guy for education, and eventually they had two team leaders, I believe, for education.
Mm-hmm.
But I was stationed in Saigon, did a lot of teaching at the Ministry of Agriculture at the Home Ec office, but that was, I worked with the Director of Agriculture. He was a Cambodian.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really fine gentleman. And I was thinking, what a sap I was. We used to travel together. He liked to go with me if he could.
Uh-huh.
And when we traveled together, we'd go out and meet the IBSs and meet his station people or provincial people, whoever. So it was a good combination, you know. If our people were having problems and whatever they saw as problems, it was easy to discuss. But I remember one time, I think we were down at Kong Song, a prisoner. I was someplace. I don't know where it was, and hot. And I remember taking off my shirt. We're working around with the Vietnamese provincial people, and that's really why I was so dumb. I mean, they would never do that. You know, that's kind of crude. But I remember the director. He did the same thing, and I think he did it. Now, you know, I loved him for it, but it was really unusual. I think he did it because he didn't want me to embarrass them. You know what? That's pretty bad. After I'd been there all that long time and ran around there with my shirt off working with those ministry people, And I think he did that so I didn't lose so much face, you know. Uh-huh. That was another thing he never understood. I never did understand losing face. You can lose face in the Orient. In the same thing in Peru, I suppose it's all over. But funniest ways to lose face, but you never really understand it. But that would have been losing a lot of face.
Yeah, that was.
But he, I think that was a real good combination for IBS. And quite often when Dr. Chen would go, we'd get somebody from USAM to go with us. Bob Bartlett was a horticulturalist. He'd usually go. But so there was somebody from IBS, somebody from USAM, and somebody from the Ministry of Agriculture, which was usually the director. And we'd go around and visit the stations, and then the IBS people, and his people, and the USAM people.
And his name was Dr. Chen?
Chen.
Chen.
Yeah, C-H-A-N, I believe it was. Uh-huh. And I think Don cultivated that relationship, mm-hmm. started that before I got there. Mm-hmm. And we used to go over to his house and have dinner. He had a son, can't remember the boy's name, but about our age, maybe a little bit younger, and Don used to go there a lot. It was a very, very good relationship. I think it helped the IBSs in the field. You know, if they have contact directly or indirectly with the Minister of Agriculture, if you really do have a problem,
right,
depending upon how you express it or explain it, mm-hmm. but I think things went really well. That was the beginning of the real security problem. Nothing like those after me experienced, but it was just starting to.
How did that affect you as a team leader? Because I know you're responsible for their jobs, but along with that goes a heavy responsibility for them as people.
Yeah,
too.
It was both good and bad. But that was about the time that USAM, I mean, not USAM, rural development people started to come in.
Uh huh.
That was, I don't know whether it was USAM or the embassy or who they were, but.
These were IVS, though?
No, these
AID folks?
AID folks. Okay. Field aid folks. We hadn't had that before. So they were in charge of the province. Right. Mm-hmm. And they, all of the places that I was working with, and I think where Mike worked too, you know, they really latched on to the IBSs. Mm-hmm. IBSs spoke the language. They had the contacts, at least agriculturally. Mm-hmm. They traveled the province generally, or a good part of it. So they were well known and knew a lot. And so it was a good introduction for these aid type people. And because they had the money, they had all kinds of money. But I think that's where some of the effectiveness started to separate too. Just because it was so big, so mm-hmm. fast, mm-hmm. and they were very goal-oriented. They had to have so many villages or so many people trained or so many roads made or that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. That brings pressure to everybody, and of course you can do those kind of things, and they did. Some of them were great, and some of them maybe not. But I think it was a prelude into the whole war situation as it expanded and certainly got worse. I was on a ship between Japan and Hawaii when they had the Tonkin Gulf incident, so that mm-hmm. tells you about. Where I was, we were at Hung Lock. I was at Hung Lock when they had the first incident. There was a grenade or something on the windowsill of the Just Mag place. We used to go down there occasionally. You know, the military guys always had steak or something, and used to water ski in the Chalpia River. Not Chalpia River. I can't remember what it was in Hung Lock, but. We get together with those guys occasionally up in Bamatuit or some of the other places. They always had American movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so the IBSs would go there a lot. A lot of them would go there for the food. But I think the IBSs, they were a good catalyst. I mean, they could work with the American military and the aid people. I think it made it easier for those two people, because the IBS's contacts lay back, but I think it bothered some of the IBSs, some of the early ones.
That this was rushed?
It was rushed, but they didn't go over there to work with Americans. And it's towards the end of my tour. That
By 64.
Yeah, that was what it was becoming. Mm-hmm. And after we left, I think it got worse and worse because more and more provinces were taken over by, not taken over, but they all had the American aid representative. In fact, a lot of the IBSs went back in those positions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, I think some of the work that they were doing before the aid thing would have lasted. You'll never know.
Mm-hmm, no.
But the war effort really changed the focus of the whole program, I think.
Give me some examples if you can. What do you mean by that?
I think it became more U.S. orientated.
Mm-hmm.
Before, the IBSs were out there and they were working with whoever it was in the province, Vietnamese.
Right.
And then the contact was back with the IBS mm-hmm. office.
Yeah.
But after that, when the rural affairs people, I guess that's what they call it, when they were assigned to the provinces, then they felt, and then maybe they did, I don't know, maybe they had right from the embassy to direct mm-hmm. the IBSs. And a lot of the problems that I had, not problems, but a lot of the situations that I ran up against was that the rural affairs guy couldn't understand why he'd ask Bob McNaff to do something,
uh-huh.
and Bob McNaff didn't do it. And Bob didn't see it as his responsibility. It wasn't something the Vietnamese that he was working with had identified as something that needed to be done. So there was a communication problem there.
So in other words, if I can try to repeat in my own words what I think you're saying,
yeah.
just so that you can see it. Most of the volunteers would always try to, at least attempt, to work on something that the local Vietnamese want.
Oh, yeah, yes.
And then the aid guys would come in, say, we're going to build a 60-foot dam.
Right.
And nobody in the village cared about a 60-foot dam.
Right.
They were more concerned about a new crop of whatever.
Whatever it was, right.
You know, or maybe working on...
They didn't see the urgency that the...
Yeah, and then he would push that to conclusion right. simply because he'd have the bucks.
Had the bucks. He had to do it, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have the contacts or the communication, but he did through the IBSer.
So and attempted to
force...
He focused
on the IBSer to get his Vietnamese counterparts to do whatever they were. And
for
it
the
may
bureaucratic
have been good,
goal.
Right. It may have been good in the big scheme of the security. I don't know. Maybe it was.
But I would doubt that it was.
Not, it was not explained that
feeling.
Way.
Yeah. I mean,
some of it was, yeah. Some of it was good.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it probably wasn't.
And I guess a lot
money.
Of it wasn't. Yeah.
It was big money, and it had to be spent, and they had to show something for it. And
yeah, and to make it in the annual report.
Right, right. And I think that's when things got tougher for IBSs. The plus to it, though, I think, was that then some of the IBSs were picked up by USAID and
mm-hmm.
became... the provincial reps, and I think that was better. They understood what the Vietnamese position was.
Mm-hmm.
But then they had their marching orders too,
mm-hmm.
from USAID. But I think it was hard for them. But I think they could still work with the Vietnamese better. Maybe explain why it was important that they were able to. The
mm-hmm.
dam or irrigation ditch or whatever it was.
Or maybe tell AID why they shouldn't worry about the dam.
Yeah, I think there was some of that too. I think if anybody could have done it, it would have been some of the former IBSs that went back in those.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll have a chance to talk to some of the IBSs that took those positions.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it would be interesting to see what their perspective was. But it was quite different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my first 2 years... In my second 2 years, the field people, that's when I think this change started to come, and I think after I left, it got mm-hmm. much, much wilder. Yeah, there were security problems.
As well, which is different from what you've yeah. just...
Like McNeff, he was up on the coast. I can't remember the province name. I got my map here. And there were places they couldn't travel. I think a lot of times they couldn't travel because...
Well, this is the map you had when you were carrying around your grandson.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is an old one that I got. This is a, this shows the ethnic group that probably won't... Tweewar. Bob McNeff was at Tweewar, and they were working back here.
Mm-hmm.
And they were having security problems. It was a lot of time. They, you know, they got more restricted, and we were just working mm-hmm. along the road.
So just south of Quinon.
Yep. And when I was down here in close to Benoit, when that's where the station was, mm-hmm. we're traveling all of this area trying to introduce cacao, and there was security then, but the difference was we always let the, because the counterpart knew, didn't usually travel with a counterpart here. The counterpart was the station manager, but we did have, sometimes some of the students would go with us. There would be somebody from the station going with and the interpreter, and then we go into a town. I can't remember what they call them, prefecture. I can't remember. The headmaster or the town leader would know you were mm-hmm. coming. And if there was a security problem,
mm-hmm.
they would tell you, but they would say, no, that isn't a good time to go there. They wouldn't uh-huh. say why.
Right.
And you didn't ask, but mm-hmm. you knew you weren't supposed to go there that day. And, you know, things weren't so important, but you couldn't schedule it 3 days or a week from now. And that's usually how it happened. I remember once, this Benoit was a big rubber plantation, so a lot mm-hmm, of French mm-hmm. rubber. I remember we were in a rubber tree.
That's the area west of Saigon. Let's see.
Well, it's north.
North and
northeast, kind of.
Okay, all right.
And that's when I was working as extension my first 2 years. We had the Jeep or a Land Rover, I can't remember, plumb full of cacao seedlings. And I can't remember where we were going.